good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Ridge of Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, well, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you're here in the Central Coast. But please hold your calls because we have with us one of my favorite guests. His name is Joel Skousen. Joel, thanks so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Stan, to be with you.
Well, Joel writes the World Affairs Brief. It's a weekly summary of what's going on in the world. Always an insightful and always a very incisive appraisal of what's going on. And I look forward to getting it. Of course, I get it by email. And I'm sure Joel will be able to tell you a little later how you can get a copy or even subscribe to his newsletter if you'd like to. But right now, let's talk a little bit about some of the things going on in the world. And I think one thing I know you want to talk about is the election. So why don't you pick up the story from there? And this is an entirely different audience that we talked to this morning, so don't worry about being repetitive.
Thanks, Stan. That is nice to know. The title of this last week's World Affairs Brief was Death of the Two-Party System. And, of course, I'm not referring to the demise of the Democratic Party, even though they lost big. In fact, these were a series of races that normally go almost 50-50 one way or the other, and they almost all went to the Republican side this time. But nearly the entire country is in most states of the union is almost split 50-50, 51-49%. So it makes it very, very easy for the media, who has a great deal of control over what people think and say, to control the outcome of elections. And essentially, I think the problem that we're having is it used to be that we had two major ideological camps. We had a very constitutional, pro-liberty, pro-family Republican Party that was for less government. We had a socialist Democratic Party with a very leftist Marxist wing of that, which wanted more and more control of government, redistribution of goods, was able to buy votes with promising benefits to people. And there was a very strong ideological difference between Republicans and Democrats. But over the years, of course, the Democrats have pulled the Republicans into the center and the left because of their superior ability to buy votes. It's a very enticing thing. It has to be constitutionally restricted. People generally don't have any natural resistance to this kind of corruption, that is, benefit corruption. And so if you want to win elections, you have to be able to promise benefits to people like everyone else. And so the Republicans started down that road. Of course, when government became too expensive and too oppressive and too regulatory, the Republicans knew that it was their job to oppose that. And that was their reason for going against more welfare statism. But what happened in the 90s, of course, is that it had progressed to such a point, and the Democrats were putting out charismatic leaders like Bill Clinton, that the Republicans came onto the bandwagon in a way never before. Well, at least perhaps it started during Bush, but it really got to be semi-socialist on the Republican side during the Clinton years. It was rather enticing because Clinton was so far to the left that it made it easy for Republicans to move to the left and still think that they're to the right of Clinton, which they were. Even liberal Republicans looked conservative compared to Clinton. But unbeknownst to people, this slow drift has corrupted the Republican Party until there's very little difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. And the Democrats, I might say, in this past election, almost universally, because of the popularity of George Bush in the wake of this rather phony war on terrorism and this knee-jerk patriotism generated by war fever, have had to move towards a moderate position as well. They've had to take up the call of less government, of more efficient government because of the weight of socialism. They aren't willing to give up their socialism, of course, but nevertheless, they did take a universal moderate position that was almost never critical of Bush. And we found that even the conservatives in the Republican Party almost were never critical of Bush. In fact, we found out here in Utah that the Republican National Committee refused to give any funds to conservative people running for Congress unless they, hands down, gave a voice of approval and swore allegiance to George Bush. So that's in a nutshell how I view what's happened in the election.
All right. And of course, you're speaking primarily of the federal elections. Certainly at the state level, at least in some states, there is a difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. But you're saying that at the national level, there's really not much more than a dime's worth of difference between them.
That's right. On the state level, there is more of a difference. But it's interesting, Stan, that you don't have the same ideological causes at the state level. You don't have foreign policy. You don't have a national taxation policy. You don't have deficit spending generally at a state level. You have to pay for things as you go. You do have some state welfare systems now, so they are getting into, especially in California you do, but in many other states they've been much slower to pick up state welfare systems. But generally you don't have the same ideological battles. You really are representing your small county, your district, and it's not as easy to make a case for the Republican Party platform. It is probably sufficient to say that at the state level, most people put on the tags of Democrat or Republican simply to woo those particular votes, even though the party platform is not that big of an issue at the state level.
Okay, fine. Well, I certainly tend to agree with you, and I'm really so dismayed to find the Republicans going into massive deficit spending. In fact, this last year, the national debt went up about $400 billion, from about $5.7 trillion to about $6.1 trillion. And, of course, that was mostly, most of that was stolen from the Social Security system. The rest of it, about $150 billion, was actually acknowledged as deficit, and the rest of it was simply doing exactly what the Democrats have always done, and that is stealing the inheritance, the pensions of future generations.
That's right. Yes, and, speaking of the party platforms of each one, it's interesting that how few candidates' feet are ever held to the fire of the party platform. It used to be that if you deviated as a Democrat from the party platform, you'd be in trouble as a Democrat, and a Republican would be in trouble if he took a position that was different from the party platform. Now there's a great divergence. Even Republicans made it very easy for conservatives to win certain conservative platforms like abortion, anti-abortion, at the Republican National Committee. And they did so, I suppose, because they knew no one was going to hold their feet to the fire if they broke those pledges and ran as pro-abortion candidates, or pro-choice, as they call it.
I think
that's exactly what's happened.
I really think that's so interesting because, of course, it always was in the Republican platform to do away with the Department of Education. And, of course, you could always put it in there because you didn't control the House and the Senate. So it didn't really matter whether it was in there under Ronald Reagan. He could always say, well, the reason I can't do away with it is because the Democrats control the legislature. And the same was true during the first Bush administration. During the Clinton administration, the Republican platform always said, do away with the Department of Education. However, when George W. Bush came in, he demanded that be taken out of the Republican platform. Why? Because, of course, it was apparent that they already controlled the House of Representatives. If they control the House of Representatives and the Senate, then how would you justify not doing what was in the platform? Because, of course, the Republican leadership never really intended to do away with the Department of Education. That is how they're going to control the mind, the outlook, the worldview of future generations.
You know, it's a very good point. It used to be that the powers that be would always attempt during the Republican administration to have, as you said, a Congress dominated by the Democrats. And it was specifically so that the conservatives would always have an excuse to look the other way or to pass off the compromises of their leaders. It was interesting that when the take the judicial nominees, for example, in Congress, whenever the Democrats are in the White House, and the Republicans, such as Senator Hatch, are on the Judiciary Committee, the Democrats and the media always gang up on the Republicans, claiming that they're holding back, holding hostage people because of ideology. And, of course, the Republicans bend over backwards to pass the Democratic nominees for Supreme Court justices and federal judge positions. Just to show that they aren't being prejudiced based upon constitutional principles. And then when a Republican president gets in and the Democrats are in the Judiciary Committee, you would think that if you're going to be consistent, that the Republicans would put forth constitutional conservative judges and complain about the Democrats for holding up those things based upon ideological, but it isn't that way at all. In fact, the media then sides, of course, with the Democratic leadership of the Judiciary Committee and says the president has to give us moderate to middle-of-the-road nominees. He cannot give us ideological nominees, and the Bush administration complies, except for one or two token conservatives that have been put forth.
And, of course, they get blocked by the liberals.
That's right.
And, of course, you know, I think one of the most interesting things about that was when Senator Jeffords was going to leave the Republican Party and join the Democrat Party. Now, you know, the president has a tremendous amount of power. He could make all sorts of offers or bribes or all sorts of things to Jeffords to keep him from switching and giving the control of the Senate to the Democrats during the first 2 years of the Bush administration. And yet, of course, Senator Jeffords went to the White House, talked to George Bush, and no offers were made at all, which then switched the, when Jeffords switched to the Democrats, it switched control of the Senate to the Democrats, and then they could always say, oh, those wicked Democrats, the reason we can't get anything through is because of the wicked Democrats control the Senate. Whereas, of course, they could have put pressure on Jeffords to keep him switching. They never tried.
Well, I am convinced that the powers that be actually wanted George Bush to become president. I think that's why the result was manipulated in his behalf. The campaign was manipulated against Gore. There was a lot of publicity given to the faux pas Gore made on the air. A lot of publicity was given to Ralph Nader and the Green Party, who increased their electoral share by about tenfold, which was sufficient to take away the electoral advantage of Gore. We do have a benefit-corrupted majority in this nation. And so no party really can be elected on ideology anymore, except for Ron Paul. He's the only one, apparently, that can. All the other people, even the 12 others that are part of his Liberty Study Group, are elected as moderate conservative Republicans, pro-Bush Republicans. Then when they get there, they tend to side more with Ron Paul on a very strict constitutional basis, but there is a lot of pressure on them. But only Ron Paul can get elected by bucking President Bush, and that's because he's been there so long, his district knows him, his district trusts him. If he were a new guy on the block, he probably wouldn't be able to get away with it. But he's probably the only exception to what I'm saying.
And of course, he has an organization that can reach the people, and even though his district is not predominantly Republican, the district he had to run in was predominantly Democrat, but if you tell the people the truth, if they understand what the issues are, There's still enough good Americans out there to take America back. The trouble is, with the media under their control and with the leadership of both political parties under the control of the same folks, why, of course, if you really want to come in and do what's right, you're not going to get a cent from the Republican Party. When you're running for Congress, I can assure you that is the case, because I've run and against a very popular Democrat, and not one cent, not one bit of encouragement, not one bit of significant advice from the National Republican Party. I was at one time the Republican congressional candidate for this district, but of course the Republicans aren't going to back you if you stand for anything.
Well, it's really true, and, you know, they have the numbers to prove it, Stan. This is one of the things, even though I think that you're correct, there are a great deal of Americans that are still good people. Nevertheless, a lot of them, I'm afraid, are very soft thinking. They really do buy into, they don't think through the consequences of the welfare state. You know, they think of the poor and the generalizations about, they don't realize that in today's society, almost all of the poor have some form of chronic bad judgment, which leads to continued poverty over time. Nobody has that much bad luck that much time. There is judgment involved, but it's very difficult to see those specifics. The media hypes up the generalities of the poor, and good-hearted conservatives fall for that. It's very difficult to be tough-minded about consequences for bad judgment, which is a good portion of what leads to poverty and mistakes in investments, bad judgment, lack of self-discipline in a family lead to health problems, bad eating habits, they lead to accidents. All kinds of things happen because of bad judgment, violating the promptings of conscience, and, you know, government coming in and making everything right financially doesn't help people learn the lessons of life that they need to. And so benefit corruption sets in. We have a greater and greater portion of the population each year that becomes less productive because of that. But it's very difficult for Christians and conservatives to be tough-minded.
No, but you see, you don't have to be want to deprive poor, starving people of either housing or of adequate food. Nobody starved to death in America before we had a national welfare program. We always had the responsibility for taking care of the health and welfare of poor people at the local community. We had a poor farm. We had a county hospital. There was always the Goodwill and the Salvation Army, where you could either get your clothing or you could buy it for just about nothing. We always supported the poor in America. We did not need a national program. But, of course, whenever the federal government gets involved, you get what you subsidize. And when you subsidize people on welfare, well, you get more and more welfare. The welfare state has destroyed the black family in America. One of the greatest tragedies of all time. And, of course, they knew exactly what was going to happen. Socialism just doesn't work. It's totally contrary to man's natural inclinations, and it goes against human nature.
Now, wait a minute, Stan. Actually, socialism is very much in line with people's natural inclinations. Most people, that is, in the bell-shaped curve in the middle group, are attracted to socialism because it offers them higher rewards than their true worth would merit in the free market. The free market will penalize people of moderate to low true worth. And socialism offers something that is enticing, that only a very few people have the kind of principles to not be enticed into higher benefits than what your natural talents and worth would merit in the free market. Everybody thinks I'm worth what a doctor makes, or at least a lot of people tell them, a lot of teachers say, I work 8 hours a day, doctors, we should both make the same amount of money.
Well, I really wonder if that was the case, because I know when I grew up, the average individual did not want socialized medicine, and I'm not talking just about the doctors, I'm talking about the people. It was really more or less forced upon us. The average person didn't want the welfare state, and the only reason they were able to get it in was because of the Vietnam War. And, of course, all of these things were really brought in under the smokescreen of the Vietnam War. There was a tremendous opposition on the part of the people to socialized medicine, to Medicare and all of those things. I don't think that the average senior wanted Medicare. Once it was there, well, you'd be foolish not to take it because everybody else was taking it. But at least in the generation when these things were brought in, there were still an awful lot of people who realized that when the government provided for you from the cradle to the grave, the government's going to be able to control you from the cradle to the grave because the government has no money other than what it takes from the people by force, prints, or borrows from future generations. Now, they don't understand that today. They've changed the attitude of an awful lot of people. But I'll tell you, 50 years ago, this was an entirely different world where people did not trust the government. Today they still don't trust the government, but somehow they think that they can take all these government handouts and still remain free.
Well, it started, of course, with soft thinking, and that's why I'm making my point, is that soft thinking, good people said, all right, let's give the limited few poor some health and medical benefits. Let's pass Medicare, let's pass Social Security, etc. And, you know, it was a small percentage. People say, it won't hurt. It won't hurt my pocketbook. It won't hurt my property rights. Failing to realize, of course, that the programs engender, they're self-growing. They engender their own future constituency. And so even those very seniors who voted for those things came onto the program because it was available. And part of the reason they came on is that government interference in the healthcare process and in the insurance process by giving tax benefits to businesses for providing health benefits, they drove up the cost of medicine tremendously. You as a doctor, of course, saw all this happen, is that when people had to pay for their own medicine, doctors didn't make a lot of money. Doctors couldn't afford to look someone in the face and charge them $2,000 an hour for, you know, some small procedure. And so that supply and demand system kept the price of medicine relatively low. But once you have nobody have a feeling, I'm not paying for it, my insurance is paying for it, and most people were on insurance due to this inducement, tax inducement to businesses to provide it, then the prices rose. Even though it was a free market system, it was tax policy that induced something that the free market would not have purchased for employees as readily were there not a huge tax benefit offered. And that drove up the price of medicine so that now those of us in the private sector who don't have insurance cannot even possibly afford insurance. Fortunately, we've been driven out of the establishment medical system and have gone to alternatives, which is much more healthy anyway. So there's kind of a silver lining in the cost. But so many of our seniors are absolutely adamant that they must have drugs paid for, because these huge drug companies are making billions off this closed, controlled system.
Well, of course, but you do. I think that the seniors are not very smart. They might ask themselves why it is that a drug will cost $100 for a month's supply in the United States and $10 for a month's supply in Canada. And I would like to suggest, even though nobody else has suggested this, that our drug companies are owned by people who are part of this establishment, and they are creating the problem because they want a solution. And once the government begins providing medicines, then they're going to be able to tell people what medicines they will use and what medicines they will not use. And a lot of medicines just will not be available in the United States for our senior citizens because, of course, they're just too expensive. We just can't afford all of these things. But believe me, what you're going to get will be free. And of course, it's the old idea in Canada why everything is free. But the trouble is you just can't get it. You want a CAT scan, you need it to determine if you have a brain tumor or an MRI. Fine, we'll put you on the list. And of course, if you're a government employee, you'll get it immediately. Otherwise, you may wait 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years before you'll get it. That's the same the way it is in Switzerland. Everything's in Sweden. Everything's free. It's just not available.
Well, and to a certain extent, we're getting that way here, for example, because insurance pays for most CAT scans or Medicare or other things. I mean, if a person had to sit down and ask, and the doctor said, well, let's run this test, and you know you were going to have to pay for it, you'd say, well, how much is this CAT scan going to cost me? And what are the benefits for it? Well, it's going to cost you about $1,200. And you say, well, I don't have $1,200. Is there any other way to determine this? Well, yes, but CAT scan's better. Well, $1,200 better? I mean, you see, people having to pay for things does make them make more informed choices. And so I think that, you know, I'm not against insurance. I think insurance is a free market incentive. If it's truly a free market, it's fine, but people ought to be, you know, having to pay more of what they get.
Well, the ideal insurance, of course, is a catastrophic policy, and that one, you know, that pays 80% of your cost after you've put out your first $5,000. And that, then, of course, the insurance rate is very, very low.
Actually, it isn't anymore, Stan. Even catastrophic is very, very high price now.
Well, then we may have to go to $10,000. I'm thinking
as well. I'm just saying it's changed. It used to be the catastrophic was that. It was quite low. Actually, it's not anymore.
Well, it's certainly a lot cheaper than, you know, than the complete, you know, first dollar coverage that you can get. I haven't priced it here in a few years, but the basic idea, if the government was out of the medicine, why the cost of medical care would fall precipitously, and these hospitals would have to charge honestly instead of jacking up the prices as they do to cover the fact that they lose money on every Medicare patient. And the only way that they can even break even is to cheat. And so we encourage cheating for Medi-Cal and Medicare patients, and then we cost shift from the public to the private sector, and of course then we price the private sector out of medical care.
Well, the only way, though, that medical care would really come down in price if it were, if you stripped away some of its exclusive licensure things. You know, the definition of the practice of medicine is so strict in most states now, for example, that you know, it's really trying to squeeze out any of the natural health practitioners, which is the real competition to the high-priced establishment medical system. If you allow it truly to compete and stop prosecuting people, you know, in that field as much as they are, and allow a continuous gradation of care from alternative, and that people can choose without this this closed door. Everything in medicine has to be licensed, and everything licensed has to go through 4 and 5 years of schooling of the type that we say, and it has to be controlled by these committees. And when you have all those kinds of controls, you really do prohibit competition.
You're absolutely right. And, of course, it's always done under, well, we're really concerned about health, and we want people to get the best quality health care, and we're simply pricing it to the point where it's going to be unavailable. I certainly see that in the hospitals. At one time, we used to have nurses' aides. They were capable. You could go to the hospital, you get a back rub, you got a lot of personal attention care. Oh, we can't have nurses. We've got to have registered nurses.
Yes,
we
sir.
Want the best possible care. Well, of course, the registered nurses now have to spend hours and hours doing paperwork. And as one of the hospital administrators said to me not too long ago, the chances of you getting a back rub at our hospital, you know, is just like winning the lotto. And what this has all been done in the name of, oh, we want to help the people. And they really don't want to. They have intentionally wanted to complicate the system so it would eventually break down. And as it begins to break down and more doctors are leaving medicine, or I spent the last weekend with an OBGYN doctor who is paying $80,000 for his malpractice insurance. Next year it'll probably be $160,000. He's just going to quit doing OB. More and more doctors are not doing OB. They're not doing neurosurgery. And the whole system eventually is going to crumble. And then, of course, they're going to say, well, now we have to have socialized medicine.
Right.
And, of course, all you need to do is go and talk to the doctors who work under socialized medicine, and they will tell you that the whole concept is to ration access to care. As the professor of orthopedics told me at Edinburgh many years ago, we have two lists for elective surgery, two lists for surgery. One is for the emergency surgery you get in immediately. The second is for elective surgery. We put you on the list. We never get to you unless you are a commissar. And that was his word, commissar, meaning a government official. And then we take you in immediately. And that's the way it works in England.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about this liability insurance, those of us who stayed out of the stock market during this boom and avoided this bust, thought that we really had escaped the consequences. But in fact, those that deal with liability insurance have found all of the premiums are being raised almost 100% last year. And the reason is because all the insurance companies have lost billions in the stock market, and they have to make it up through premiums.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Joel Skousen. We'll invite your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there all across America listening to us, we hope that many of you will decide right now that you're going to join the Radio Liberty family, because quite frankly, we need your help so we can continue expanding our coverage across America. And right now, we have about 50 stations that carry at least some of our programming every week. I wish we were on every day on all those 50 stations. Some of them in maybe just half an hour a week. Some of them it's every night. Sometimes it's 2 hours a day or 4 hours a day on some stations. But at least we have a voice, and some people are hearing the truth, the information they're not going to get elsewhere. And so if you believe there's a problem in America, if you believe that behind the political and ideological and cultural battle, there is a spiritual battle taking place for the souls and hearts of men, then we hope that you'll decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family. And, of course, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like to partner with us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God in freedom can long endure. And then, of course, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, we'd be glad to send it to you. If you haven't had one before, I suggest our October newsletter because, of course, it's the suppressed testimony of Christian Breitwiser before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the real cause of what happened on September 11th. Christian's husband, Ron Breitwiser, died in the South Tower on September 11th last year. And she is part of a organization of the families of the victims of September 11th who don't believe a word the government's saying and know that they're covering up the truth, and they're trying to get an independent investigation. And, of course, the Republican administration is doing everything they can to block that, even though the vast majority of members of both the House and the Senate would vote for an independent evaluation of what's gone on. Why the administration refuses to allow that. And the only question is why. And as I talked to Stephen Push, who represents another group of families, his response was, well, obviously they have something to conceal. And if they have something to conceal, and it was because of September 11th, we're about to enter a war where hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people may die, don't you think it would be important and significant to know the truth? Well, you're going to get the truth in our October newsletter, which is the suppressed testimony. Oh, it's up on the Internet. It's just that the media has never told you what Christian Breitwiser said on the 18th of September last year. So when you get our newsletter, you're going to get the information that you're not going to get elsewhere. The news behind the news, the story behind the story. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV. War. And then, of course, we want to mention the conference we're going to have on preparation for the difficult times that lie ahead and how you will want to prepare yourself financially and physically and spiritually for what is about to occur. And I, of course, been at this for 40 years, and I can, I've been wrong before, but I don't think we're wrong here. I believe we're in for very difficult financial times, and I believe that many of the people listening to this program, if they do not make preparations, are going to find themselves exactly as the people of Argentina are today. Half the population of a previously prosperous country, Argentina, live in poverty today. A year ago, they were prospering. A year ago, the good times were rolling. A year ago, everybody believed it couldn't happen, and it did happen. And you better start thinking about what happens when a nation goes deeper and deeper and deeper into a debt, spending money it doesn't have, because no nation in all recorded history has spent itself into prosperity, and yet we are the greatest debtor nation in the world today. And the Arabs now, the Muslims are coming up with a new gold-backed currency that challenges the supremacy of the American dollar, and if that is introduced for the 1.2 billion Muslims throughout the world, and they begin demanding a gold-backed currency in return for their oil, without which we cannot survive, well, you're going to see the collapse of the American dollar, and you better be prepared for that possibility, because if it occurs, everything that you have gambled on and believe is going to give you security, you're going to find will be gone. Well, we hope that many of you will decide you're going to come to our conference. It's going to be from, well, it's going to start at 8:45. The doors will open at 8:00. They'll close at 6 o'clock. You'll be with us for 10 hours. There's going to be a luncheon. There's going to be the syllabus we're preparing. We need to know how many people are going to be there. And so if you're interested in coming, why, call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV. I think you'll find it a fascinating day as we, of course, go into what's going to be needed for preparation for the difficult times that lie ahead. Again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America truly is under siege today. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our special guest today is Joel Skousen, who publishes World Affairs Brief. Joel, how can people get in touch with you? How can they get your publication?
The best way, Stan, is for them to go on the Internet to my website, which is www.joelskousen.com. That's JoelSkousen. Now, if they don't have access to the Internet, they can call my office number, area code 801-224-4746. That's 224-4746, and they can request a sample briefing. I have a print edition that comes out at the end of each month, covering all of the 4 or 5 weekly editions each month. There's one special issue that I put out 2 weeks ago called The Big Picture, which covers the difference in worldview of this coming conflict, and I try to describe how I think it's going to happen, why the wars of intervention that Bush and Clinton have been engaging in the past 10 years are going to lead to World War III, what the timetable looks like, what are some of the factors to watch for. So it'll be a very interesting brief for you to have. And it's free of charge. Anyone who wants to call that number can get a free copy of The Big Picture. If you want to email me at joel@joelskousen.com, I'll send you a copy of The Big Picture as well.
And I think it's well worthwhile reading. I hope you're not right, but I fear you may be. And I think it's something every person needs to read. And I will tell you, I always read through Joel's material from beginning to end when it comes on a weekly basis. And, of course, getting it by email is a tremendous advantage. But if you don't have that, you can get the monthly edition. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to give us a call, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. And I'd just like to ask you something. Of course, we hadn't prepared this, but what is your take on the financial situation? Your brother, of course, Mark Skousen, is well known as an economist, and certainly I think he has the Foundation for Economic Education today?
Well, he was. There was a large conflict there at the foundation over his inviting Rudolph Giuliani to speak at the Liberty Banquet. And Giuliani is not viewed in the conservative libertarian movement as someone friendly to our side. And so he and the foundation have parted ways over that issue.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but what is his feeling, or what are your feelings on where we stand economically today?
Well, my brother is very optimistic and positive, as are almost virtually everyone camped by the money tree, because they have a vested interest in wanting this to continue. I do take the opposite position from my brother. I believe that all of the fundamentals point to a serious recession, if not a major depression coming that will exceed that which would happen in 1929. The only thing that is keeping that from happening is massive periodic intervention from the Federal Reserve in combination with about 5 or 6 major brokerage houses, which constitute what's called the plunge protection team. And they intervene by buying futures in the S&P 500, which allows them to have a tremendous amount of leverage on the market. And they also do it through hedge fund managers that are connected with this plunge protection team, At any given time during one of these rallies, fully 40 to 60% of the stocks being purchased are being purchased by institutional hedge buyers and this plunge protection team. And when the market goes down, what this really is happening is this is people who have been holding on and waiting for a rally in order to sell stocks, and that's why the stocks keep going down. The plunge protection team has not been able to keep this market going up. If anything, they are at best going to be able to do a relatively soft landing. The slower they can make this, allow this thing to go downward, the easier it will be for various people to transition, find new work, and keep things going. So while I believe that a major recession and depression is coming, I do believe that there still is a fair amount of strength in the economy. A lot of that is because of the offset of cheap goods flooding in from China and Mexico, Malaysia and other places. All of that really is to our detriment security-wise in the long term, but nevertheless it is a benefit in terms of deflation of prices, offsetting the hidden inflation that's been going on in our country. But there still is a good deal of strength in the economy. But the trouble is, people are so specialized now, people are so overextended and heavy into debt, that once things start to go down, the demise will be fairly rapid because just very few people have any reserves to hold on. And there's a snowball or negative multiplier that takes place once sufficient numbers of people lose their jobs and buying power decreases and people stop spending, and then the inevitable snowball rolling back downhill will happen.
Okay, well, let's go to Bob, who's calling in here from Santa Cruz. Hi, Bob. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, hi, Dr. Stan. In regards to the concept of, quote, socialism and the concept of, quote, free market that have been introduced tonight, I wanted to introduce the concept of unmerited favor and unfair advantage.
All right. So go ahead. What is your point to make?
Well, I think that one can justify government intervention domestically in the name or the goal of attempting to improve universal access to resources.
All right. So in other words, you believe the basic Marxist concept to each according to their need.
No, you're saying that.
Well, but isn't that what you're advocating? Is government reassigning material wealth to people?
I have no problem with the phrase redistribution of wealth.
All right, fine.
None whatsoever.
Okay.
Now, if I might also add to that, the reason why is that clearly any conscious adult is aware of unfair advantage. Economically,
right, you're
there is not
right.
A level playing field. Therefore, modern governments rise to the occasion. They attempt, as imperfectly as they do, to improve universal access to resources. And that isn't communism. That isn't socialism. It's just simply good practice.
Yeah, no, it is socialism. That's exactly what the socialists want. Our concept of government, the Constitution, did not give the federal government the ability to redistribute wealth in the name of helping people. The whole idea of our Constitution was to limit the power of the federal government. You don't believe in the Constitution. Let me just make my point, and then you can make your point, and then we'll let you go. You believe that it is the function of the government to redistribute wealth. I do not. I believe in the Constitution, which did basically limited what the federal government could do to dealing with the affairs between nations, to dealing with the affairs between states. And there are only about 18 things the federal government can do, like weights and measures and building, having a postal system. They're all laid out in Section 8 of Article 1. There is no place in our Constitution for the Marxist redistribution you advocate. Now, what was your point?
We have the right and the power and the authority to nationalize the banks and or privatize the post office. That is the reality of any honest interpretation of the Constitution.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much. But I would like to suggest that your concept will lead to a dictatorship because that's exactly what Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini did. Thank you. Okay, Joel, Bob is...
Let me comment on what he...
All right, fine.
Briefly, He focused on, which is very typical of the liberal mind, is they focus on a on a benefit, or they take an injustice or an apparent injustice and they focus on a universal benefit solution, but they fail to realize that there are hidden victims to every one of those policies. For example, they might say that employers have inherent advantage over employees because they own the resources, they own the factory, et cetera. The employees don't have much leverage. And so they mandate benefits. And what they fail to realize is that in the hidden victim concept is that for every time you mandate benefits, you actually destroy the power of someone else to get a job. Because when you have mandatory employment controls and regulations and benefits, it puts the businesses that are at the margin out of business, or persons like myself when I ran my architectural business, because of the load of regulations, etc. I chose, in fact, not to hire any employees anymore. I reduced my staff from 7 employees down to 1 myself and went to computer-aided drafting. And even though I took less work, to me it was worth it because of all of the hassles involved with dealing with government employee regulations. So you see, the mandatory redistribution of wealth causes hidden victims. They're less that the people have to purchase because of the money that's redistributed from them. And that money is never redistributed, he says, more justly, but it really isn't, because it's never more efficient. There's all kinds of waste and graft and greed that goes on. People are made wealthy. I mean, you create masses of injustice through the, as he said, imperfect as government is. Well, it's very nice to gloss over that, but it's so grossly imperfect compared to the free market that I really dispute his whole proposition that the level of injustice at the private area or advantage, which isn't necessarily injustice, even comes close to the massive injustice in corruption, in the trillions of dollars that we have in government, in the trillions of dollars in terms of massive deceit in accounting in our government, and in the trillions in corruption and drug dealing that our government has. I mean, this man has to be able to look at what's real now, not what he sees in this ivory tower view of liberal goodness.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. What the average liberal who sees the injustice in our society, and of course he feels it all has to do with wealth and the wealth unequally held, what he doesn't understand is that some of the wealthiest people in our society, some of the most corrupt and evil, are the very ones who are pushing and financing this whole socialist concept, pushing it into our schools and our universities, because they realize that when all power is localized in Washington, D.C., and held by politicians who have no restraints at all on what they vote for, because we've changed the structure of our society from a limited central government to an all-powerful central government, and of course those politicians can readily be bribed by gifts, and as a result of that, we do away with the concept of freedom, which we once had, and now we suddenly have a situation where the very wicked and most powerful people often are the ones who control, buy, and sell the politicians who determine our future. And I think the hardest thing for people to realize is that many times the people of great wealth, and I'm talking about the Fords, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, are the very ones who are pushing socialism.
You know, you bring up an excellent point there about the corruption of politicians, but it also corrupts the electorate as well. Benefits that can be taken from a general distribution pot makes everybody corrupt in the sense that everyone is vying for their piece of the pie. It is a recipe for disaster in a democracy, and a democracy always leads to this, is the rabid scrapping for their piece of the pie, and everybody wants a greater piece. And so that's why the free market is inherently non-conflicting, because competition and judgment, and you have limited powers to coerce anyone to do what you want to do. In the model that our listener was suggesting, everybody has a power to get his hand into the pot, and it leads to unlimited conflict over time,
and that's
well as bankruptcy.
That's what Alexander Tyler said before our Constitution was written. Democracies are temporary forms of government. They last only until the people find they can vote themselves into the public trough, and then everybody wants to get their share of the pie, and eventually, of course, there's overspending, there's collapse of government, and the institution of a dictatorship. Democracies are temporary forms of government, always followed by dictatorship. Let's go to Ron calling from Richland, Washington. Hi, Ron. How are you doing? Ron, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, a question or comment?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, yeah.
Yes, sir. A couple of things. I was reading a book called Our Nation Betrayed by Garland Favorito. Is that a good book?
I don't know any, I don't know the book.
Yes, I've read it. Excellent book. I highly recommend it.
All right. Anything else, Ron?
Yes, sir. I just want to let you know that I am a flaming liberal with my own money. In fact, government, if you read the Bible, government is commanded to be a terrorist. It's to be a terrorist against those who do evil. It's not to redistribute goods. It's not to take from the citizenry. Jesus commanded us, those that have been blessed, to bless those others who are less fortunate. In fact, we will answer to God. We won't answer to Caesar with what we do with our money.
You're absolutely right. That's a good point.
And I'll tell you, I gave 40 times more to charity than Al Gore did, even though I make an awful lot less money.
Well, of course,
I'm not a tremendous philanthropist either. I just think the guy's kind of a tightwad. He's just a tightwad with his own money. He's not a tightwad with other people's money.
Isn't that so true? You know, the liberal, you look and see how much, what percentage of their income they give to charity. They don't give hardly anything to charity, but they want you to give your money to charity. And they feel, well, they've done enough when they've paid their taxes, and they want to increase your taxes to do the good things that they think ought to be done, which they could do on their own. Without the government interference, but they refuse to do because they're not really interested in helping people. They're interested in more government control over the lives of the people.
Well, the greatest health, education, welfare institution that's ever been founded was founded back in the Garden of Eden by God. That's Adam and Eve, husband and wife, and the family, living as mandated by God in a godly fashion, looking after each other. Charity begins at home. And then it extends out in concentric circles, and we will be called into account by God for how we use the largesse that God has given us.
Now, what is your thought on that, Joel?
Well, I would only moderate with that God gives us his grace through conscience and the ability to judge right and wrong, and that's why in every private charity, the reason why it is so much more efficient than government is that judgment goes on. It isn't meeting a bunch of sterile rules. You basically hear the case of the person, and you see how much of it is his own fault or bad judgment, and sometimes you even give a little bit even when there's his own fault, if they're really repentant and want to make a change. But that's why chronic problem people don't merit and will not get charity, because we have no right to undo the judgments of God. He gives consequences to people for bad judgment, and the purpose is that they might learn. So I would caution that the mandate for charity from God is not without judgment and without due care in accordance with the promptings we get from God.
He who will not work will not eat.
Okay. Anything else, Ron?
Oh, sir, except keep up the good work.
God bless you. And, of course, the knowledge is there in the Bible. And, of course, fear of the God, of the Lord is the beginning of all wisdom. Okay, fine. Well, of course, we've gotten a long way away from where we started out. We were talking about the elections. Anything else you want to cover there, or do you want to talk about the upcoming war?
There were some bright spots in the election. 18 out of 23 pro-Second Amendment congressmen supported by Gun Owners of America, a favorite Second Amendment lobby, won their elections. They still had to do that by swearing allegiance to George Bush, but the Second Amendment is still very, very strong. Anti-gun people are having a tough time. They beat that drum for so long, it's not, we're not winning in that regard. What we are losing, though, in general, is that Republicans have become firmly convinced that compromise is good, and that's what led to all of these victories, and I'm afraid it's going to be used against those of us who really believe in taking an ideologically hard stand, going to make it very tough, because they're going to always point to this election. You see, we won every one of these tight races because we compromised. We went along with George Bush. We didn't bring in ideology. We didn't bring in tough issues. The point that I want to respond to is that there are things worse than losing an election, and one of those is losing your freedom. And, you know, we can continue to win elections and lose our freedom. And so what good is it to have won the election? That's my question.
Well, I think the big thing is, how do we get back to the Constitution? If the Constitution was being respected and obeyed, as every congressman does and every elected official does, when he is sworn into office and he swears to uphold the Constitution and defend it against all enemies, public and private, or foreign and domestic, but they don't even understand what's in the Constitution. What we need to do is educate people and create an awareness of the amazing wisdom our founding fathers had when they created and signed that document.
My only objection, though, to education alone is that a lot of people, if they really knew what the Constitution would restrict, wouldn't like it at all. And they would reject the wisdom of the founders because they like these benefits. Even many of our conservative seniors who are on Medicare, if they realized that Medicare was not proper according to the Constitution nor any of these mandatory Social Security, they would say, well, then I'm against the Constitution. And that's the problem with benefit corruption. So as a practical matter, I think the only way that we can, as pro-constitutional conservatives, have any political power is by making a pact from now on that we will not vote for the lesser of two evils. We've got to start to vote for constitutionally consistent third parties, even if the only result is to cause Republicans to lose an election. That's the only way you're going to get the Republican Party to say, all right, now we've got to listen to our conservative constitutional right-wing side of our party. Right now, they say, we've got no place to go. But that isn't true. You can go to third parties and you can cause them to lose, which will then, if they are redeemable at all, which I have some doubts, it will cause them to have to give us, you know, some say in policy.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. Joel, do you have any thoughts for our listeners this evening?
Well, a lot of people have been wondering whether or not this election portends real change in American politics. I say it does not. In other words, even though the Republicans have got an overwhelming victory, it was only by a bare margin in any of these small races. The real problem is that we have total uniformity among both parties, and it's the major message is yes to everything the government wants, and that's going to be very, very dangerous under George W. Bush because he's taking us into globalism and to a loss of personal freedoms and constitutional freedoms through this Homeland Security Act.
Well, I would not disagree with that at all. I think you're right on. God bless you. Thanks so much, Joel. We look forward to having you back here in the very near future, and we'll discuss more of the problems facing America today. Good night. Thanks
so much. Good night, Stan. Thank you very much.
And this is Dr. Stan, and of course, this is the time when we have to bid good night to our listeners up there in the Great Northwest and ask them to pray for America and remember to pray for our Ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And right now we have with us from up in the Sacramento area, Randy Thomason from the Campaign for California Families. Randy, how are you?
Hey, Dr. Stan, doing well.
All right. Well, I thought that you'd be a little discouraged after what happened last week.
Well, I was, but you know what? I do think there's hope for California, and I want to tell you why.
Well, why? I mean, I'll tell you what. We're going to have one of the biggest debts in the world. You know, the rating of our bonds is going to be pretty close to that of junk bonds. Nobody may want to buy them. You know, we're losing the industry from Silicon Valley. People are leaving California. The good people are leaving California. Industry is leaving California. We're going to have a tax rate to rise to deal with this massive budget that they have and the budget deficits. Tell me the good things now, Randy.
Well, I think in looking at all of this, it was a tragic lost opportunity for Bill Simon. Although he had many, many problems, I look at him as not being the lesser of two evils, but I thought there was implied accountability for him on a lot of issues. Not that I know what he believed, but he sure said it to a lot of people, I'm pro-family, and to legislators who said, yes, he's pro-family. And so I said, well, look, let's believe that these people will hold him accountable, people who get paid huge salaries at the Capitol. Let's determine that they're going to hold him accountable and so forth. So I was sad when Simon lost because I think that what with Gray Davis here, we've got a whole bunch of yuck coming down the line. I do want to say it was Simon's to lose because there was a lack of message overall. You can't present a million messages. You can't just do it normal. You've got to be creative. If only Simon had basically said, look, I'm going to protect all the rights of marriage. I'm going to protect parental rights. Gray Davis isn't. You know, deal with the energy crisis. Maybe even if Simon had wrapped himself around Prop 52, rather against it, this liberal and radical same-day voter registration initiative failed mightily. 3.8 million people voted against it. It would have been good, I think, if Simon said, look, I'm very much against that, too. He was saying Davis is corrupt and I'm a refreshing alternative. That wasn't good enough for many. But I don't think it was a rejection of morality that Simon lost. I really believe that it was about personalities, inexcusable blunders, a muddled message, and a big lack of money. For example, why didn't President George W. Bush come in the last days or weeks like he did in other states? Where was the Republican National Committee? Where was Gerald Parsky, who is the money man at the California Republican Party? Losing by 5% isn't that much. And I think that all the people who voted for Simon and not for Davis, they got pretty close. I call it a near miss.
All right. Well, I think that there were people on Simon's staff who were against him. I know that he was told that by one of his advisors, you ought to fire your whole staff and get in people who are in favor of you, and he refused to do anything. The fact that he would not fire his gay supporters who put out that letter that totally disrupted, destroyed the confidence of the conservative Christian element in this state as far as this campaign was concerned. The fact he didn't have the courage to fire that man for sending in this questionnaire that Bill Simon said, I never saw it. I never signed it. If he wouldn't even have the courage to fire a man before the campaign, what would he do when he got in office? He would compromise on everything. And I think that was the Bill Simon we saw.
Yeah, and I think in the big picture, because there were so many problems, that was basically it. I ended up voting for Bill Simon, and asking other people to please consider doing the same, because not that we say the lesser of two evils, but rather the greatest good, and somebody who basically would be held accountable by those who said he would. I mean, there's oftentimes I vote third party, but this was not one of those times in all the races. Some races I did. But I want to give people hope. Dr. Stan, you know that California is in a political dynamic. More people are leaving the two main parties behind. They're registering as voters as declined to state or independent. I think it really speaks to that voters are hungry for issues and standards. And look at it in this perspective. The liberals have pushed their agenda far to the left and beyond the sensibilities of average people. And on the other hand, too many conservative messages and spokespersons have been muted because of their own fear and doubt. Now, I'll agree with Hillary Clinton on one thing. Issues do matter. And I'm completely against the things she stands for. But pro-family values help families and pocketbooks, and the anti-family agenda is destructive and needs to be exposed and opposed. And I really believe this from my heart, Dr. Stan. If pro-family citizens stay in the battle, increase their involvement, learn to communicate, and learn to lead, future victories are really inevitable.
Well, they aren't, as long as the current leadership is in the Republican Party at state level. And I will tell you that we had an excellent candidate. His name was Bill Jones. I think Bill Jones was an intelligent...
He'd be the governor-elect today, I think.
He would be the governor-elect today, and he was sabotaged by the Republican Party here because they didn't want the people to have a choice. In fact, I think there were people working with the Republican Party who wanted Gray Davis to be elected. Bill Jones was not getting the support that he needed. And he had a massive flyer to go out, to the entire population. It arrived 10 days after the election. Do you think that happened by accident?
You got to wonder about it.
This is a standard method. This is the way that they use, to keep the people from learning what the issues are. And somebody within the post office just held that up. It's happened to me here in Santa Cruz when we were running for the Central Committee. And they simply held those back for 10 days until they knew that, of course, the people would not have them for the election. I believe Bill Jones was sabotaged at every turn. He was a conservative. He was a fiscal conservative. He was a traditional values supporter, very brave and courageous individual, and he would have made an excellent governor. And I believe that there were the leaders of the Republican Party didn't want him. I believe that they wanted to give us a Tweedledum, Tweedledee situation, they ran the weakest Republican they could find, and they sure succeeded.
It was very, very interesting. I mean, I want to say a voice to people right now. The Bible says, let us not become weary of doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. There were victories around the state. A pro-family Hispanic group called Latinos Por La Familia ran radio spots exposing Gray Davis's pro-abortion and pro-homosexual everything views, and it made the Democrat Party chief Art Torres very upset because the truth was getting out. Down in San Diego County, East San Diego County, pro-family citizens who waged a 10-year war have actually won control of the second largest school district in the state, the Grossmont School District. It was an incredible victory, and again, 10 years of labor. And so I think we can just build on the momentum from this election and just keep working away. So I want to say, lastly, don't give up or drop out. Don't move out of California. Don't wallow in depression. Instead, see God's face for his direction, ideas, and vision. Think about ways you can be salt and light to be active. I mean, Dr. Stan, after this election, we're really rethinking the strategy, but we're going to have a strategy, and I'm really calling this a near miss for the pro-family community. There's no question in my mind that with a stronger candidate and campaign for governor, we'd have a pro-family governor-elect today. And we'd have actually some people who were pro-family Republicans on the down ticket, like Keith Olberg for Secretary of State, Tom McClintock for Comptroller, they'd be in office too.
Tom didn't make it either?
Well, it's still in contention, and that's because it's an absentee battle at this time. Tom McClintock is anywhere from 23,000 to 30,000 votes behind Steve Wesley, who's a liberal rich guy from San Francisco. So that race is still to be determined. But I see that the leader, Gray Davis led people in the office, Bill Simon didn't, but it was very, very close. I mean, when you look at the battles, Dan Lundgren lost by 20% in 98, George W. Bush lost by 11% in 2000, and Bill Simon lost by 5% this year.
I think the fact that Bill McClintock, who, incidentally, for our listeners out there, is a fine Christian gentleman, the fact he would be that close to becoming the controller, and if you saw all the ads were on the other side. I think there was only, a couple of ads I saw immediately before the election for McClintock, and despite all of the tens of millions of dollars that were spent on the other side, the fact that McClintock had come that close really shows that there are an awful lot of good people still here in California.
Well,
I agree with you.
I think that the look at Hispanics are wondering, you know, who represents the family values. There's a lot of people who just want principled politicians. And so I think for the election of the future, candidates should not be afraid to say what they stand for. They should not stand for nothing, because nothing means you lose. And you've got to desire to win. You've got to expose your liberal opponent. You've got to say what you stand for and articulate it well, but don't be afraid. And I think that victories are inevitable in the future. We've got a great, I think, a good message on our website, SaveCalifornia.com, entitled There's Hope for California. And I'd like to invite your listeners to visit SaveCalifornia.com, because we've got to learn from this in the midst of the pain. We can learn and let this election be a teacher for us so there can be future victories.
And let's your telephone number and people would like to get in touch with you, Randy.
916-443-1410. Leave your name, your address, and tell us you heard us on the Dr. Stan Show, and we'll send you a free newsletter. There's a lot of good done this year, but there's just a lot of there were a lot of problems that happened in these campaigns. And so I just want to encourage people to stay in the battle.
I want to tell you, Randy, I've been at this battle for 40 years. I'm more encouraged now than I have been in 40 years. I really am. And so there are a lot of good things happening, and we'll be telling our listeners about a lot of those good things in the near future. Anyway, thanks so very much.
Thanks for you, Dr. Stan.
Thanks for everything
Bye-bye.
You do. Bye-bye. And that was Randy Thomason of Campaign for California Families, and we'll have Brad Dacus on with us in just a couple of minutes. And then our surprise guest for the last part of the program is, Open Line. So we'll invite your calls, and if you are a hardline Marxist and you want to tell me why we should redistribute the wealth of this population to try to create a utopian society when all of these have always failed through the years, why, I would love to hear from you. But right now, we're going to be talking to Brad Dacus of the Pacific Justice Institute, and Brad, of course, is going to be one of the visitors, one of the speakers at our conference we're going to have here on the 23rd of November, the weekend before Thanksgiving, and we certainly hope that you'll want to be there. And if you would like to come, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. It's going to be all a day-long program. There's going to be a luncheon. There's going to be a syllabus. We have to have an idea how many people are coming, and we have to get those figures in so the cook can know how much to cook in preparation for the we're getting, I think, a very, very good turnout for this time, but we hope many more people want to be there. And right now, Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute. Hi, Brad. What's going on?
Well, I just wanted to cover what happened in this last week's election. And from our perspective, from our legal litigation perspective, I know many people watch our cases and also watch the legislation. It comes down from the state capitol, but we expect there to be some bills that were tabled or vetoed that are going to come back to life in this next spring. And because the fact Davis was reelected, the liberals still have control of both the state senate, the state assembly, and I think that's sort of made news in and of itself. We have some cases and other things we're working on right now. Some new ones we're working on, but I think it's it's a good time to stop and just assess what we're going to be dealing with this coming year. Senator Assemblyman Tim Leslie told my office that for us not to expect them to be able to stop any of this legislation at all, and for us to just to start preparing to be able to challenge it on constitutional grounds when some of these bills are signed into law that may impact, for example, Christian foster care agencies and Christian foster care homes that don't want to put kids with homosexuals and things like that. So it's we've got some real serious issues we're going to be probably dealing with next year.
Well, I'm sure glad we've got you up there at the Pacific Justice Institute to help Christians as they come under persecution. And, we're looking forward to having you with us down here on the 23rd for our seminar. And would you like to tell people your website and about your telephone number if they'd like to get in touch with you?
Oh, you bet. And I'm really looking forward to that seminar. That's going to be a really exciting occasion with some really good information to discuss. Two ways. Our telephone number is 888-305-9129, 888-305-9129. Our webpage is pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org, and it's a real honor and privilege to be able to participate in that upcoming event on the 23rd.
Okay, we'll look forward to seeing you then, Brad. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dr. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute, and he's out there on the front lines, of course, trying to get the information out, and of course, more than that, actually taking cases to court defending Christians who are coming under attack by the anti-Christian bigots who are increasingly prevalent in our society today. Well, of course, we have nothing really planned here for this last half hour. So if you have something you'd like to talk about, give us a call. But, you know, when I got out of college, I was a sort of a muddle-headed idealist. And I really believed, as one of our earlier callers did, look, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could just redistribute the wealth, and then everybody could be wealthy? Or some people are so very, very wealthy. Shouldn't they be required by law to give part of what they have to help the people who need it so much? And, of course, it's a wonderful utopian idealistic concept. But, of course, the reality is it just has never worked throughout all history, and it never will work now, because socialism does not work. The only place it will work is in something like a kibbutz, where there's a common racial desire, and there's people driven by a common belief, but they're there voluntarily. They're not forced to be there. They're there because they want to. A communal system will work in a monastery. And it works there because the people are there voluntarily. And yet somebody has to be in control of that monastery. There's got to be a father superior or a mother superior, and they're going to direct things, because if somebody isn't in control, it just doesn't work. The problem with socialism is it's a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory, but it doesn't work without force. Somebody's got to be in charge. And it's sort of like if, you can look at the streets of our town. If you didn't have somebody come around and clean the streets, why, they wouldn't get cleaned. In other words, the average person is not going to stop his car and pick up the trash by the side of the road. There has to be somebody who does that specifically. If it was their front yard, they'd be out there cleaning it. But if it's somebody else's front yard or a communal front yard, is that going to be kept clean? It would be a very unusual situation. What people do not understand is that the difference between our form of government and a socialist form of government is that here all men were guaranteed the right to life and to liberty and the pursuit of happiness, not to happiness. You were not promised anything in our Declaration of Independence. You were promised the opportunity for happiness, the pursuit of happiness, and you might fail in what you did. In a free society, a man is guaranteed only the right to try and either to succeed or fail. In a Marxist society, of course, they're going to tell you, of course, we are going to provide for you from the cradle to the grave. But the problem with that is that the government that can provide whatever you need must be able to take whatever you have. And the government that can provide for you from the cradle to the grave has to be able to control you from the cradle to the grave. These ideas have been tried time and again down throughout history, and they just don't work. Democracy doesn't work. And you can go back and you can read what Plato wrote in The Republic, and he said, 375 years before Christ was born, democracy doesn't work. Of course, the Republic that he advocated was a feudalistic society, returned to a feudalistic concept of government with a philosopher king, a ruling oligarchy, a military and police that would control the populace, and then everybody else would be subordinate to the state. You'd do away with marriage, which, of course, is the building block of our society, but there'd be no marriage. And in this idealist utopia that Plato wrote about, all women would belong to all men, the children would belong to the state. That is exactly, of course, what is being advocated today. People didn't understand, but many of the people who are working behind the scenes within the secret societies, and there are secret societies, there really are. And if you don't believe there are, you go to your local metaphysical bookstore and get some of the books there written by Alice Bailey or by Annie Besant or by Aleister Crowley or by Madame Blavatsky, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. And there are secret societies working behind the scenes, behind all of the various powerful organizations which we see at the highest levels of our government today, the CFR, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, the Club of Rome, the Skull and Bone Society, and behind that and within the framework of all of these organizations is the occult force which energizes them all. Well, right now, of course, we'll go to Nathan, but let me point out that all of these various organizations have certain things in common. They want a one-world government, and they want socialism. They want this all-powerful socialist society. And when you read the writings of people like Benjamin Cram and his magazine, Cher, or you read the writings of these occultists, you find that they all advocate socialism. Why? Because socialism, stripped of all of its idealism, is a system of force and control. Well, right now we have Nathan calling from Contra Costa County. Hi, Nathan. How are you doing?
Oh, good evening. Good evening.
And I was reading your letter you just sent me and was enjoying some of your remarks there. I'll have to compile a reply when I get to it, but right now I've got about about a pile of letters and emails about 2 feet high. So if you've written to me out there or you've emailed me, don't be surprised you haven't got a reply. One day, hopefully you will. But go ahead, Nathan.
Take your time and do it at whatever pace you need to. Basically, I wanted to get your comment on this. There are, of course, two basic different socialist philosophies that need to be understood. The first would be corporate socialism, or let's say monopoly, and this would be the form practiced under, let's say, a fascist system, under a corporatocracy. It was also the form. It's also the form practiced in China and the former Soviet Union. Some say the still standing Soviet Union. It's the kind where there's a top-down dictatorial elite, called New World Order, called Skull. You know, the Skull and Bones could be said to be advocating covertly this type of, not advocating outwardly, but working covertly for this type of socialism. The other type of socialism we can call Grand Orient Masonry, or the Marxist kind, or the democratic kind, or the anarchist kind, which of course is the idealistic kind, the kind where theoretically everybody's equal. And of course how these two interact, I think, has defined much of the 20th century, and you know, it's a complicated subject, and I just wanted to get your comment on it.
Well, of course, these are all theories. If you study the theory of communism, I mean, communism does not come about until the state has withered away. And then, of course, men can live freely. In the meantime, you will have a dictatorship of the proletariat. If you go back and you read the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx recognized that, first of all, you had to go through the stage of the dictatorship of the proletariat and socialist and social democracy, used that term repeatedly, until, of course, mankind was refined. And then, of course, we could have true communism and true freedom. The trouble is that after 80 years in the Soviet Union, the state never withered away. And, of course, it was never intended to wither away, because Karl Marx wrote in glowing terms about the downtrodden masses and how, of course, you needed to modify society, overthrow the existing social order, and establish this utopian society. But that was never what he intended. What he really intended, of course, was exactly what Lenin accomplished, and that was a new ruling elite. And that's what you had in Russia. That's what you have in Russia today. That's what you have in China today. And, of course, what people don't understand is that our leaders, and I'm talking about our great corporate entities and our banks and our Federal Reserve System, began financing the Soviet Union back in 1918, shortly after the October October Revolution, the Second Revolution when Lenin took power. And, of course, we continued to finance it always after that. Communism just doesn't work. And it would never would have survived without constant infusions of money and technology from the West. And the same really is true of Communist China. Communist China is making advances only because of massive infusions of money and a material wealth and technology from the United States. But even more than that, of course, people have to understand that our ruling elite works very, very closely with the totalitarian elite, because our ruling elite and their feels a sympathy for these other rulers, these people of wealth. And, of course, we want to manipulate them and control them, just as like one day they would like to manipulate and control us. But under neither system is there any opportunity for the individual. And both concepts result ultimately in the total destruction of individuality and freedom and hope. And, of course, if they are successful, of God.
Well, I agree with you very strongly, but I disagree with you weakly. In other words, I agree with the essential framework of what you're saying. I would say, though, that the existing social order that Marx was referring to, whether in its feudalistic or in its capitalist form, would be again, the corporate socialists or the skull and bones or, let's say, what exists in China now, or the former Soviet Union, or basically the existing social order, whereas I think what he would have wanted to do would be to overthrow that and institute an atheistic sort of revolutionary social order that ideally would sweep away the existing occult hierarchy. And I know that John Daniel's Scarlet and the Beast definitely goes into that conflict. Although, you know, they both seem to be cooperating in the basic concept of a one-world order, a one-world government. But according to Mr. Daniel, they definitely don't agree in terms of what type of one-world government.
Now, who doesn't agree? Are you talking about the Marxists or the corporate socialists or what?
I'm referring to when you say the Marxists, if you're referring to the Soviet Union, China, and these sort of dictatorships, no, there definitely is a strong agreement with other elitists.
Now, basically, John Daniel was talking about the schism within Masonry, not the schism within various forms of socialism.
But he goes a lot further. He actually explores the schism, in a sense, but he explores the schism between the English feudalistic paradigm and the sort of French revolutionary paradigm, and that's basically what I'm trying to get to, that both of these advocate what you might call a form of socialism, but there seems to be, although there is a unity that's very deep within both of them that he definitely explores.
But
there's also something beyond both of them, which is very scary and definitely would deserve its own conversation.
But basically, John Daniels, and for our listeners out there, John Daniel wrote a book entitled Scarlet and the Beast, and we have a four-tape set on my interviews with John Daniel. But he is really talking about Masonry, and of course, he's talking about the Masonic movement, the English Masonic movement, the French Masonic movement, and the schism between them, which he feels, of course, is responsible for many of the political forces which exist in the world today. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, yeah, and he also explores the extent to which certain what we would call dissident movements anywhere on the spectrum might be factions controlled by one against the other or maybe even by both. But, you know, the basic framework of what you're saying I do agree with. Don't get me wrong. We can quibble over the term socialism or what they really mean.
Okay.
If you're saying that the basic tendency of society now is towards a more controlled system where, you know, people are detained without the Bill of Rights and all the rest of it, we certainly agree on that. I'm definitely not arguing with you. Your basic essential point I agree with. I'm just introducing this other point for debate, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, well, anything else you want to say?
Oh, no.
Let me just say one thing. Everybody talks about the idealism of Karl Marx, and, you know, he was this great champion of individual freedom, and he wanted to create this utopian society where the state would wither away. Nobody ever asks who put up the money. Who financed Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto, because somebody put up the money for it. And the fact that most people have never heard of the organization that financed Karl Marx is simply a reflection of the degree of control that today exists over what the American people think. And when we get back from the 3-minute break we're about to take...
I'll just say I agree with you, and I'll let you go.
All right. God bless. Good night, Nathan.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. It was we'll tell you about the Society of Jest when we get back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when once again we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to us out across America for your support. And if you believe in what we're doing, if you believe that America faces its greatest crisis of all time, if you believe that we need the support and help of people, why, we hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And it's as simple as giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And people who do join the Radio Liberty family, of course, get our 4 best tapes of the month, my monthly newsletter. Some people just want the monthly newsletter. A lot of people listen to the programs or tape them at home. Really, whatever you'd like to do to help, but to join us in this struggle, because it really is a struggle, and we are beginning to reach out increasingly across America, and we are beginning to have an effect, and not because of what we do, but because of what the listeners out there who believe in us do in helping us. And little bit by little bit, we've been able to expand from 1 radio station to 2, to 4, to 6, to 8, to 20, to now we're up to about 50 stations across America that carry some of our programs, 50 outlets across America carry some of our programming every week. And we're talking about shortwave, internet, satellite, or radio stations. And so we have a unique opportunity to reach people. Sometimes we'll take a station on, and if it's just not producing, why, we have to let it go. We can't continue broadcasting on stations if we're not getting a response. So, but if we know people are out there listening and they're responding and appreciating what we do, why, then, of course, we stay on those stations, and we have some wonderful, wonderful stations, get a tremendous response from the people there, because they're beginning to learn and understand, and then they can begin to tell others. And that's really what it's all about. We'll try to teach you to understand what's happening, and then we hope that you'll reach others who will reach others who will reach others. And gradually, more and more people are beginning to understand the foundations of our freedom, the difference between socialism, this idea of redistribution of wealth, and freedom. You can't have a government that can redistribute the wealth of the people unless have freedom too. And believe me, whenever they're redistributing the wealth of the people, they're not redistributing the wealth of the very wealthy. I mean, they have, for instance, inheritance laws, so that people in the middle class have difficulty, passing on to their children and their grandchildren what they've amassed. But they have special laws for the wealthy. They have all the foundations and all sorts of means by which they don't pay the taxes. And what you have to understand is the system is not designed to redistribute the wealth of the wealthy, but of the middle class, and to impoverish them and their children and their grandchildren. So, until you understand that all of these systems are not made up for the reasons they were supposed to, and you can never embrace them because you're never going to be able to change the power structure in our society, at least not as it's currently set up. So what we have to do is try to get back to our constitutional concept of limiting the power of government so that it cannot be used and taken over by the wicked people. The great tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller and Carnegie and Ford, and the Pew and the other foundations that are out there, the Packard Foundation, that are using their financial power to restructure our society, not to help the little man, but of course to enslave him and bring him under the control of the all-powerful government, which they themselves control. And their people from the great foundations migrate in and out of government and in and out of powerful positions throughout the world, well rewarded for their treachery. In fact, I was just reading this evening that Janet Reno had put in, I think, 5 years working as a state attorney general and another 1 or 2 years working for the state of Florida, and now she gets a retirement of $700,000 a year. Gee, isn't that wonderful? I wish I could work for somebody for 6 years and make $700,000 a year, or is that, of course, payment for services rendered? Can that sort of thing happen in America today? Well, according to Colonel Tom McKinney in his newsletter he just put out, he mentioned that. So, you know, this is the sort of things that happen. But we don't want to let the American people to understand that, you know, if you go along with the system, if you're willing to misuse your power and cover up things like, well, what happened there at Waco and with the murder of all of those good people, why, of course, you'll be well rewarded, just as Bill Clinton got $10 million for speaking engagements the year after he left the White House. He got the $10 million advance for his book. Have you read his book? Oh, well, we haven't told you he hasn't written the book he got the $10 million for, but don't you worry, it'll be written or somebody will write it one of these days. Do you honestly think that they're going to get back $10 million, you know, by selling his book? I mean, they only got $8 million for selling the Pope's book. He only got $8 million for his book, and there are probably, you know, well, probably a billion Catholics out there who would want to read the Pope's book, but how many people or how many Catholics do you think would want to read a book by Bill Clinton? How many Protestants or Christians would want to read Bill Clinton's book? No, these are simply payoffs for services rendered. This is how the system works, you know, and the people who go along with this idea of redistribution of wealth are well rewarded with your wealth for their services. So, but let's just point out that we hope that many of you out there will want to join the Radio Liberty family. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We hope that many of you out there will want to come to our conference on the 23rd of November. And, of course, you do that by letting us know you're going to be coming. It should be a good day. We're going to be talking about what you're going to have to do to prepare yourself for the very difficult times that lie ahead. And, again, our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is at war today. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, if you're out there in the listening audience. And we were talking about Karl Marx, and of course, Nathan was suggesting that Karl Marx really really wanted this sort of this utopian form of socialism, and you read the Communist Manifesto, it really sounds pretty good. But nobody ever talks about who financed Karl Marx. Well, first of all, he was financed in part by Frederick Engels, who was the son of a wealthy capitalist. Oh, a wicked capitalist is financing Karl Marx, but of course, most of the money for financing Marx and his family came from something known as the Society of the Just. Now, before they rewrote the British Encyclopedia Britannica, before they rewrote history, people in past generations knew about the Society of the Just. And in my 1913 British Encyclopedia Britannica, under Marxism, they tell you that Karl Marx was financed by the Society of the Just. They don't tell you that anymore. In fact, you're not supposed to know that there are secret societies that have always been there. But the Society of the Just, and remember, the Communist Manifesto was written in 1847 and published in February of, I believe, 1948, pardon me, February of 1848, in preparation for the revolution that would come later that year in France and that would sweep across Europe. And, of course, all of these revolutions were planned ahead of time, but the Communist Manifesto was to be the rallying point for this wonderful utopian society they hoped to obtain after they overthrew the existing social structure. The Society of the Just, which financed this, all the indications are it was directly tied back to the Illuminati. And you can read some of the writings of John Daniels and other people who have really studied these secret societies that existed at that time. You read the writings of James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, in his book Fires in the Minds of Men, and he goes into the background of how this whole world occult movement was focusing in and actually fomenting the world revolution and Marxism, and he pointed out, you know, that many people do not understand the origin of the world revolution. And it really began when the Masons began to take the lighted candles off the Christian altars and place them on the occult altars of Masonry. And it is this occult movement behind the scenes responsible for this whole world revolutionary movement and this move towards socialism. Its purpose was to overthrow the existing social structure and replace it with a new authoritarian structure, which would be under the control of the Masons. And, of course, Fire in the Minds of Men, one of the most important books in my library, written by James H. Billington, Librarian of Congress. He's not a small-time fish. He's a very important man. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a brilliant historian, and acknowledged by all of the liberals as a brilliant man, and he certainly is one of them. But, of course, his book, Fire in the Minds of Men, really gives you tremendous insight into this whole world socialist movement. And as he points out, that, of course, the communist revolution did not begin in 1917, as most people believe. It began in 1789, and even before that, in the Masonic temples of Europe, and tying into the Illuminati, as this whole world revolutionary movement was planned, and it culminated in the revolution in Russia in March of 1917, and then later in the revolution in Cuba in 1959, which brought Fidel Castro to power. And James H. Billington recognizes how, all of this whole world revolutionary ferment ties into the occult, into Masonry, and the secret societies, and there have always been secret societies. Now, anybody who talks about them today is poo-pooed and marginalized, and, oh, he thinks there's a conspiracy. Ladies and gentlemen, there's always been a conspiracy, but neither James H. Billington or certainly Professor Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, recognized that really behind the secret societies is the occult, and behind the occult is Lucifer himself. Because there really is a devil. And there really are demonic forces. There really are demonic manifestations. In fact, you can see them in this whole UFO controversy. Are there UFOs? I'm firmly convinced there are. Have I ever seen one? No, but my wife has, and she just described in great detail exactly what she witnessed. I've certainly read Chuck Musler's excellent book on alien abductions. Do you know that there have been over 50,000 people who swear that they were abducted by aliens, and all of their stories are almost identical? I'll never forget many years ago, I suppose it was 35 years ago, some fellow in Santa Cruz claimed he'd been abducted by aliens. And I thought, oh, this guy's got to be crazy. The more I read this and study it, I believe he's absolutely right. I believe that there are alien abductions, and I believe that there are UFOs, but they're demonic manifestations. And until you understand that there is another world out there, it's a satanic world, it's a spiritual world. And what really energized Karl Marx was the fact he was a Satanist. And certainly in my book, I quote from Reverend Rembrandt, who had actually spent 14 years in a communist prison in Romania being tortured for Christ, being tortured to try to destroy his Christian faith. And, of course, he didn't understand when he was being tortured why they were so intent upon destroying his Christian faith. You would think that they would be happy enough just to have him out of circulation. No, they had to destroy his Christian faith. And many of the priests, many of the ministers who were with him either went mad or renounced their Christian faith, and he never did. Eventually, they released him. And then he began to try to figure out why this had happened. And as he studied the life of Karl Marx and the writings of Karl Marx, it became increasingly obvious that Karl Marx was not an atheist at all. He was a Satanist, and the people who knew him recognized he was a Satanist, and he wrote poems about Satan. But you see, we don't teach that in our schools today. We don't describe that in our modern textbooks, because you're not supposed to understand that Satan is alive and well, and that the story of the Bible is true. And, of course, that's why they've gotten into our seminaries, and they've convinced many of our ministers that there's no Satan, there's no hell, there's no eternal punishment. The gospel of Jesus Christ has been a gospel, has become a gospel purely of love. Why, a God of love would never allow anybody to be punished just because they were sinful and done terrible things? Oh, no, no. That's just not the gospel. Well, it is the gospel, and what you need to do is get the Bible, and we've got too much theology and not enough Christianity. You ought to get them, begin to read the New Testament. You'll find that our Lord talked far more about hell than he ever talked about heaven. And that's why he was sent to earth, to die for our sins, so that we wouldn't have to have eternal damnation and punishment. But you see, of course, if there is no hell and there's no danger of eternal damnation and punishment, then there was no reason for Christ to come to earth to die for our sin. And if there's no need for him to come to earth, we don't need a Savior. And of course, that's the reason that the world is in the problem it is today, is because they've undermined the very fabric of Christianity. And that's what this is really all about. You see, the satanic forces want to undermine our religious belief, because when they've accomplished that, they've accomplished exactly what they want. First of all, they convince us that there are no demons, there is no Satan. And, of course, as they tell in that wonderful story written by C.S. Lewis, as the, I think it's Dialogues with the Devil, maybe the title of it. And, of course, one demon is saying to the other, and when we finally convince them that we don't exist, at that point, we will have almost won. Well, I don't think most people today really believe in the demonic world. They haven't talked, as I have, to Jane Whiting, who was a victim of a satanic ritual abuse when she was a child, and of course, telling me about their counseling of the people who are satanically possessed, and seeing them levitate off their chairs in their living room, levitating off their chairs in their living room. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there are supernatural things that occur. Everything is not governed by the laws of nature, not when you're dealing with this satanic, demonic world that is out there, and this is what's energizing this whole move towards the New World Order and the New World Religion. This is what energized Karl Marx and Lenin and Stalin, and this is what energizes at least the leaders of the people within our government who financed Lenin, and the people in the British government who financed Lenin and maintain this terrible, ruthless, bestial tyrant in power, as he slaughtered his own millions and millions of his own countrymen. And then, of course, he was replaced by Stalin, who killed somewhere between 50 and 60 million of his own countrymen, consolidating power. And the same thing happened in China with under Chairman Mao, who we brought to power by our policies here in this country, of course, to ensure that the suffering of the Chinese people and their destruction of their society would be completed. And, of course, not only did Chairman Mao kill 60 to 80 million of his own people initially, but then in the period between 1959 and 1962, he killed another 40 million by a planned starvation, and that was totally deleted, totally removed from the reality of the American people. And it was during those years I first got started this in 1962. And I'd never heard of the Great Hunger in China until recently, when I read the book Hungry Ghosts, and I talked to Stephen Mosier, who had lived in China, had known many of the people whose families had survived that horrible, horrible famine that killed 44.5 million human beings in that period between about 1958-59 and 1962. And the fact is, you've never heard of that, simply as a reflection of the degree of control that exists over what the American people think. The book, Hungry Ghosts, interesting study, is try to get a copy. I got my copy off of Amazon.com about 6 months ago. I hope you can still get it there, because the publisher doesn't have any more copies. I wanted to carry that book, but I wasn't able to. I couldn't get copies through the publisher, but maybe it's still available through Amazon.com. Or if you want to get other copies, why, I can put you in touch with people who do research books that are either out of print or are actively being suppressed. And sometimes these books are actively suppressed, sometimes by their publishers, sometimes by the establishment, sometimes the copies are bought up, because they don't want the American people to know the truth about what's really happened. After all, the fact that we back this ruthless government that would kill all those members of its own people, 44.5 million Chinese, according to the head of the Population Control Institute, the Population Research Institute, I say, Stephen Mosier. This is what he told me on my last interview with him. 44.5 million people were intentionally starved to death in that 4-year period, and the American people were never allowed to know. Until you understand that the media is controlled, our reality is controlled, our emotions are controlled, and now, of course, we're moving into a third world war. And I really fear that terrible, terrible things are going to happen, and of course, as a result of this war, why our society will change and never be the same again. Certainly, the First World War changed the world and began to change America. And it was during those years that certainly the legislation was put in place in 1913, but it began to be implemented, the income tax, the Federal Reserve System, the 17th Amendment, new labor laws, all during that era between 1913 and 1918. And of course, the Second World War have really changed America. And then we began to have withholding tax, and the income tax became part of our way of life because we had to have an income tax to arm ourselves so we could have a strong military to protect us from the wicked communists. But nobody ever pointed out that we'd been funding and helping the wicked communists at every turn. And then, of course, we had to go to war with them in 1949. We had to go to war in Korea because there were a lot of people who remembered that why we'd fought the Second World War to bring freedom to the people of the world. And then our State Department had turned Eastern Europe over to the communists, and then our State Department had turned China over to the communists of Chairman Mao, and people were saying there got to be communists in our government. And so how do you do away and with that concept? How do you distract people from beginning to try to find out what's really going on? Why, of course, you have another war. And so we had the Korean War. It wasn't a war we ever tried to win. We never went there to try to win. In fact, we did everything we could to help the Chinese communists, including things like putting the 7th Fleet between Formosa and the mainland so that the Chinese nationalists, well, it wasn't we were trying to protect Formosa, Taiwan, from the Chinese communists. We were trying to protect the Chinese communists from the nationalist army, which was now armed on Taiwan. And so that, with the 7th Fleet in place, why the Chinese communists could move a million-man army off of the mainland up into Manchuria to come down in Korea to kill our boys. Now, that story is told in MacArthur's book, Reminiscences, and a Major General Courtney Whitney's book, MacArthur's Rendezvous with History. Get the books and read it. And then ask yourself that question, how could it possibly be that the Chinese communists would know that once they had their million-man army off the coast of China adjacent to Formosa, that we wouldn't pull our fleet out, and then, of course, they would be subject to an invasion for Formosa. How did they know ahead of time what American policy would be? And then, of course, you read the books, and in both MacArthur's Reminiscences and in Major General Courtney Whitney's book, MacArthur and His Rendezvous with History, they both books quote a statement made by General Lin Piao, who led the Chinese communist forces that it crossed the Yalu and killed our men and captured so many of our men in North Korea. And General Lin Piao had written, I would never risk my troops and my military reputation and cross the Yalu if I had not been guaranteed that Washington would restrain General MacArthur from cutting off my supply lines and retaliating against my lines of supply. Now, how did General Lin Piao know that when General MacArthur didn't know that? You see, there were always secret agreements made behind the scenes that the American people were not allowed to know, that the American military were not allowed to know, that the young men who were sent overseas to fight communism were never to know that our leaders were working with the communists and had secret agreements with the communists. And the same thing is true with Vietnam. We never tried to win the war in Vietnam. It was as phony as a $3 bill. And you talk to the people who were there, and they know that we were never allowed to put any mines in the harbor at Haiphong, because if we could cut off the influx of weapons through Haiphong, the war would have ended overnight. We could have sunk a ship in the mouth of the harbor there, as the French had. We could have mined the harbor. We didn't. Weren't allowed to do that until we were already committed to pull our troops out. And then we went in after we put in the mines. Then we removed the mines. But see, then nobody could ever say we didn't mine the harbor. And people are so short-sighted, they couldn't remember that we never tried to stop the influx of weapons. We could have bombed the rail lines leaving Haiphong. And of course, cut off the supplies. We could have bombed the dikes and flooded North Vietnam. We could have bombed the hydroelectric plants. We could have bombed so many things, but we were never allowed to bomb them. No, we would send our fighter planes up there, three fighter planes in a squadron, each one with a third of a load of bombs. We could have sent one plane with a full load of bombs and of course, done exactly the same thing, but then we wouldn't have had so many planes to be shot down, so many boys captured, so many weeping widows and weeping wives. You have to understand, we're dealing with organized evil. The man who is responsible for that, Robert Strange McNamara. And if you, of course, go to list of on the World Future Society, the list of their board of directors, who will you find, at least until recently, under their logo, a circle made up of three sixes? Right. Marie Strong, Barbara Mark Shepherd, who had her book, The Revelation, the book of co-creation, was channeled to her by a spirit. And, of course, Robert Strange McNamara. And, of course, the World Future Society, their logo was a satanic symbol, 666. They've changed it since we began talking about it, but we have the original copies if any of you want to get them, or you can see that symbol in Kathy Burns' wonderful, wonderful book. It's entitled Freemasonic and Occult Symbols. They surround us all the time. Robert McNamara was close to Marie Strong. He used to go, he and Kissinger would go to Marie Strong's center there, the Bach of the Occult Satanic Center in Colorado, set up by Marie Strong, whose wife was a witch, at least according to an article in West Magazine, which we have, which we do make available. But you see, you're not going to read about this in Time Magazine or Newsweek Magazine or U.S. News and World Report. You're not going to understand the occult forces which work behind the scenes of Marie Strong, a multi-billionaire, the Secretary General of the First and the Second Earth Summit and the Earth Summit Plus Five and the leader of this whole move, one of the authors of the Earth Charter, which now, of course, lies in the Ark of Hope, the satanic counterpart, the Luciferian counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant. And when you begin to understand how this all fits together, and you understand that behind everything going on today are these dark and sinister spirits or forces, then you can begin to see how this all fits together. And you begin to understand, of course, that communism and socialism were always energized by these dark spirits or forces. Karl Marx, who wrote the Communist Manifesto, who advocated democratic socialism, who laid out a 10-point program to bring socialism to the United States, Karl Marx was a Satanist. Yes. And you go into the background of Stalin, it said that as he was dying, he was raising his fist in the air and cursing God. And that's what it's all about. It's that eternal spiritual battle that began in the Garden of Eden has been played out today, and of course we are being thrust into this because we're going into the Third World War that will have a profound impact, even a greater impact on America than either the First or Second World War. And the fact that nobody's telling you this, the fact that so many Americans are championed, they're excited, we're going to a war, we're going to take care of that wicked Saddam Hussein, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of innocent civilians are going to die over there. But believe me, what goes around comes around. And I'm firmly convinced, and everything I read from their plans, and I'm specifically speaking of the United States Commission for Security in the 21st Century, a CFR committee that released its report in September of 1999. We carry that. It's called the New World Coming Report. And they will tell you there's going to be Americans dying on our own land here in the United States. That's the New World Coming Report. You need to get it. You need to read it. And, of course, we'll have copies available there at our seminar. And, well, ladies and gentlemen, pray for America. Pray for revival. Help us get the word out, the understanding of the demonic and satanic forces which are at work in our society today, possessing the heart and soul of our leaders of our country. And, of course, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
had to think a little bit and get sort of going on it.
Well,
that's good if the fellow called me. I mean, you know, it was a great way to keep the program going.
You're talking about Bob?
Yes. That was pretty good. I did exactly what Joel Scalson did. I voted for a little white old Gusty. I was so disgusted with the climate of Davis that I voted for white old Gusty. And, you know, Steve and I both made that decision that we're not going to vote for candidates who don't really stand up. You know, I'm not going to have my little name